Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, before his trip to Dayton, author Mitch Albom talks about his latest book. Amy Lee with the Kettering Foundation talks about communities confronting the achievement gap. And Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio. Up first, our final road trip to Western Ohio, the land of the cross-tip churches. WYSO producer Eileen LeBlanc visits an historic fort in Mercer County.
After the Revolutionary War, the frontier was Ohio. Crossing the Ohio River from Kentucky was crossing the threshold to the new land. The pull of the unknown territory was vast, fertile land, ownership, and possibilities for the new country of America to expand and gain power. But there were several nations of Indians who were not all for these plans.
We had two major Indian battles. One was in 1791 and the other in 1794.
What is now Fort Recovery is very near the Indiana border and right on the Wabash River. A reconstructed fort is here now. We walk behind the fort with Helen Lefevre, who is president of the Fort Recovery Historical Society.
The Indians were fighting for control of the land, that they could live here peacefully, not have the white settlers coming in, taking the land, claiming the land.
The new president, George Washington, had sent Commander Arthur St. Clair here in 1791 to wrest control from the Indians. St. Clair came here with a bit of a ragtag army, which was somewhat poorly supplied. Here he met Little Turtle with the Miami and Blue Jacket with the Shawnee, plus many others who had joined forces in a tribal confederation.
Soldiers, there were about 1,300. Along with some women and children that were here. And Indians, we never have an exact number, but it was over 1,000 that were here as well.
And so they beat back the white man and their troops.
Well, it was a very, very decisive battle where the Americans were beat quite vigorously. And so... The word got back to President Washington, and they had to rethink how they were going to handle it from here.
The defeat did not sit well with Washington, and Anthony Wayne was put in charge. Wayne was a no-nonsense commander, and he had a reputation for discipline and exuberance and punishment for not training to his standards. He was nicknamed Mad Anthony Wayne, although no-nonsense Anthony Wayne might have been more accurate.
He sent a contingent out here to build Fort Recovery, since this was the site of the battle. They did that in December of 1793.
And why did he call it Recovery?
From what we understand, they wanted to recover the land that had been lost.
The Indians lost the battle in 1794, but Blue Jacket made another stand against Wayne at the Battle of Fallen Timbers near present-day Toledo. Again, a defeat for the Indians, which then led to the Treaty of Greenville. The Greenville Treaty gave the United States all territory south and east of the line. The 12 Indian nations were given goods valued at $20,000 and a promise to deliver goods to them annually forever. You can see a point on the treaty line today at Fort Recovery. I'm Eileen LeBlanc.
You can download the new Ohio Guide tours at seeohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Mitch Albom, author of Tuesdays with Maury and the Five People You Meet in Heaven, has a new book out. It's called The Timekeeper. He'll be in Dayton October 4th, and recently I got the chance to speak with him about his latest story. First, a little background from the author.
I grew up in South Jersey, just outside of Philadelphia. Never intended to be a writer. I was a musician all the way through school, never wrote a word. Lived over in Europe as a musician and then came to New York City and became a musician in the starving, failing category. And eventually turned to writing for a local newspaper as a means of doing something during the day when I wasn't playing, musical gigs, and found that I had some aptitude for it, and I've been writing ever since.
And do you see a correlation between writing and music?
Almost definitely. Yes, I always say that the reason I was able to probably become a writer fairly late in life, I never really studied it as a child or anything, is because there is such a correlation between music and writing, and the rhythm of the words, the rhythm, the cadence of the sentences. And sometimes when you read a book or a newspaper article and it's so fast and breezy and you just keep reading, wow, this is such a quick read. And then you read another book that's exactly the same length and you keep going back over the pages and you get lost. A lot of that has to do with the rhythm of the sentences and the beat and the cadence of the flow and the conversation and the whole theme of when you write music and come back to a theme and then explore and then come back to a theme. So there's most definitely, to me anyhow, a huge correlation.
And you mentioned that you discovered you had talent or abilities with writing. Was it pointed out to you after you turned in several pieces to someone?
Well, I guess if they ask you to do another piece, that's your best barometer. I don't know. I could tell that I was able to capture things rather quickly, which, of course, is important when you're in journalism. Yeah, I got one newspaper job and then another, and I guess I got into Columbia's journalism master's degree program, and I guess that was an indication of maybe I had some aptitude, because I guess they wouldn't have taken me if I didn't. And there I learned from some really great teachers, and I think when you're around great teachers and then you come out and you start working with great people, you can sort of feel if you're getting better at it. It's up to other people to judge if you're any good at it, but I think you can feel when you're getting better.
Let's talk about Tuesdays with Maury. How did that evolve, and was that your first successful work?
I had mostly worked as a sports writer until that point, and I had written a couple of sports books that had done pretty well, but I was really just singular in my focus of sports. And Tuesdays with Maury was the story of an old college professor of mine who was dying from Lou Gehrig's disease and who I had been very close with in college and then had lost track of for 16 years while I was sort of busy doing my career and trying to make a name for myself. And I was reunited with him when I saw him on the Nightline program talking about what it was like to die from this terrible Lou Gehrig's disease. And I flew out to see him once, and I thought it would just be a one-time visit, but we were sort of taken with each other again, and I began to go back every Tuesday to just sit and talk with him about his life and what he could teach me before he died, and found out at one point during our visits that he didn't have enough money to pay his medical bills, and so I got the idea to maybe write a book to help him. And it wasn't initially well received by a lot of people who I went around to. They didn't think I could do it or didn't think it would be interesting. But eventually I found one publisher who wanted to do it, and they printed a small amount of copies, gave us enough money to pay his bills, which is all I thought we would ever make. And then the book just hit a chord. I mean, I don't know how to describe what happened with Tuesdays with Maury. It wasn't supposed to be a big book. They printed 20,000 copies of it. I think at last look, I don't really keep up with it, but somebody told me it had sold 17 or 18 million copies around the world, and so that's a long stretch from where it began, and it kind of took me in a whole different direction.
And The Five People You Meet in Heaven was your first novel?
That was my first novel, right, 6 years after Tuesdays with Maury.
And tell me about where the idea came from.
Well, that was partly because I was so paralyzed after the success of Tuesdays with Maury, I didn't know what to do. I certainly couldn't find any nonfiction subject that would match up to the success of that or even the interest in that, and I was afraid anything would pale by comparison to be unfairly judged, and I didn't want to do that to anybody real. And so I said, well, why don't I try a novel? At least if I fail, the only one they'll point fingers at is me. And I tried an idea about, that it's been something that I had thought about for a long time, the fact that a lot of people go through life thinking that they don't matter or they don't count. And I thought that that's very sad because I believe everybody counts and everybody counts the same. I created a story based on an old uncle of mine, a very magical, fictional story. He kind of was a blue-collar laborer who never thought he mattered. And in the book, he's an amusement park worker. He's a maintenance man at an amusement park, and he dies trying to save a little girl from an accident. And he doesn't know if he saved her or not. All he remembers is trying to push her out of the way from a falling cart, and then everything went black. And he wakes up in heaven, or at least the first stage of heaven, and finds out that the first stage of heaven is where you meet five people from your life who you had some effect on. Some you might have known very well, some you might have only known for an instant, but you changed their life forever and they changed yours. And he meets these five people and kind of finds out that his blue-collar, meaningless life that he thought he led was actually very significant and touched many, many people.
What I just finished is your latest book, The Timekeeper, and I would like you to tell us what you can about the plot of this book.
Well, The Timekeeper is probably, of all my books, the closest to The Five People You Meet in Heaven. It's also a magical novel, kind of a fable, only this time instead of dealing with heaven, the subject is time and our total fascination and infatuation with time. We're so wrapped up with it. We all want more of it. We wake up in the morning to an alarm clock and spend the rest of the day around watches and digital displays and constantly trying to be efficient and waiting for emails in 2 seconds and texts instantly. And it just seemed to me we're so wrapped up in time and yet we don't understand anything about its real value. So I created a story, again, a fable about, this one is very sweeping. It goes back to sort of the dawn of mankind, the very, very first person to ever begin to count time, because there was a stretch where we didn't count time. We didn't know what time it was. We didn't know what day it was. We just lived. And I'm fascinated by the idea that we just could get up in the morning, get through the day, and then go to sleep, and no one was thinking, gee, I'm 37, or I'm 50, or this is my birthday, or I'm not being efficient. And then at some point, somebody began to count time. And in my book, he's a guy whose name is Dorr, but he becomes Father Time. He's the first person to put a stick in the ground and start measuring the shadows, and then he creates a water clock, and then he creates the first primitive calendar. And instead of being rewarded for this, he's punished by the heavens, because the heavens believe that you're not supposed to count time. And so he's banished to a cave, and he's forced to live forever. It's sort of like, well, you wanted to count your time. How's this? You're going to live forever. And during that forever living, he's in this cave constantly having to listen to all the voices from the world that are asking for more time, you know, another hour, more than 5 minutes, give me longer, give me another week. And it's almost like water torture. And he stays there for eons. And finally, he's given the opportunity in our time in 2012 to return to Earth with an hourglass that sort of can freeze time. And he's told, go back and find two people on Earth, one young and one old, and see if you can teach them the true meaning of time. And if you can, then you're free, and your purgatory is over, and you can finish your life. If you can't, well, then you're going to be stuck living this way forever. And so he comes back to Earth with this hourglass, and he finds these two people. One's a teenage girl, and one's an old rich tycoon. And he is sort of charged with trying to teach them what neither one of them understands about time, and we find out if he can do it or not.
With the story being largely about time, it also struck me that it was a book about distance as well, the distance between a teenager and her mother, the distance between a dying man and his wife, and he's got things going on in his mind that he can't tell her. So there's a personal distance between these characters as well.
That's right, and a lot of that is because of how they choose to spend their time. And the teenage girl ends up wanting to kill herself after a romance that she thinks she has with a boy, but he really didn't, kind of falls apart, and she gets exposed on the internet. And then the old tycoon, he thinks he's so important because he's so rich and powerful, that he says the world basically can't survive without me, and so he decides rather than succumb to a disease, he's going to freeze himself and come back 200-500 years later when diseases are cured, and he's going to pick up his life and live from there.
Well, it's a beautiful story. I'll tell you, I picked it up during a commercial watching television thinking I'll just, you know, kind of rip through the first page or two. By page 7, I was hooked. By around page 38, I was in love with the story. And by 72, I was, like, just completely into it. I did have to take a break and sleep, but I finished it the next night at about 2 in the morning. It goes back to what you were saying about writing and its association with music and the pace and the tempo. To me, it would have been like shutting a song off in the middle of it.
That's
I really couldn't put
kind.
It down.
That's so kind of you. Thank you very much.
You're going to be in Dayton on October 4th. Touring, promoting this book.
Right.
How's it been received so far?
Well, you know, as we're speaking, it's only been out two or three days. So the nice thing for me, and kind of ironic for a book about time, is I spend sometimes 3 to 6 years working on these books, and people tend to read them overnight. You know, I guess that's good. And one of the nice upshots of it is you get quick reviews. And so as talking with you, as you said, it's only been out a very short period of time. You already finished it, and you had nice things to say. And so far, everyone who has finished it, they've been very positive. I always add a caveat that generally people don't come up to the writer and say, I read your book, it stinks. So I may not be the best person to ask, but I do know that a lot of people have found that it's pertinent to their life. And I think that that's what I was hoping, that if I was going to pick a story or a subject like this, I've tried to do that with all the books I've written, not just have it be something that interests me, and boy, I want to read this, but have it be something that other people tap into as well. And I think the issue of time and how we're spending it and how much we have and the feeling that we're all running out of it or not being efficient enough is a universal kind of thing right now in 2012. So hopefully the book finds a nice audience.
I've been speaking with Mitch Albom. His latest book is The Timekeeper. Mitch, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Jerry, it's been a pleasure.
Author Mitch Albom, he'll appear in Dayton October 4th, starting the day off on Fox 45 in the morning. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. The Soshi Talks program is designed to enlighten the world with knowledge from primarily institutions of higher education in Southwest Ohio. This week, Amy Lee with the Kettering Foundation talks about communities confronting the achievement gap. First, this excerpt from a Kettering Foundation documentary on the subject.
Ask any education expert what the achievement gap is, and they'll tell you the persistent gap in academic achievements between white and minority students, between affluent and low-income students, between English-speaking and non. Education experts have been researching, analyzing, and probing the causes of this gap for over 30 years now. In fact, one of the major goals of the No Child Left Behind Act was to eliminate the gaps between these different groups of children. And no wonder. This gap, often double digits in test scores, graduation rates, and college completion rates, has disastrous effects that extend far beyond the classroom and schoolyard. The disparity in academic achievement is linked to a variety of problems: lower lifetime earnings, an increased dependence on social services, a higher incidence of crime and imprisonment. Many states determine how many prison cells to build based on the rate at which third graders are reading below grade level. Education professionals have been trying to diagnose and fix this problem for years now. Yet, despite all the studies, the conferences, the reports...
That was the introduction from the recent documentary that was produced last year called No Textbook Answer, Communities Confront the Achievement Gap, that was a partnership between Think TV and the Kettering Foundation. The reason the Kettering Foundation was interested in producing this documentary was because it actually helped illustrate a couple of points that they have found over and over again in their research. One is that when experts name a problem, the community can have a really difficult time getting engaged with the problem and doing anything about it. And the achievement gap is a perfect example of this. The achievement gap is a very technical name for the problem. Education policymakers will know what you mean by it, but when you talk to average people, regular people in everyday communities, even if their kids are the ones who technically are making up the gap, they don't call the gap that. Very few parents, unless they were super, super engaged, would ever recognize that as the name of the problem. It's more a problem that education policymakers and teachers would use to describe the problem. But if only education professionals and policymakers and teachers are using that to describe the problem, then the community's not having a conversation about it at all. The community doesn't even recognize that name, and they certainly don't see anything that they could do. They don't talk about it, they don't see anything they could do about it, and they don't take any action on it. So it was a really good example of that. When the community actually talks about the achievement gap, when you explained what exactly was meant, the gap in test scores between black and minority and white students, between affluent and poor, between rural and inner city and suburban. When you explain that to them, they could kind of see what you were talking about, but they actually saw it as being being a lot of gaps, not one big, huge gap, but just lots of little gaps, and not necessarily gaps that had anything to do with not all the gaps had a lot to do with the schools. So another point from Kettering Foundation's research that it illustrated was that solving the achievement gap, being a kind of fixing education, is not actually a technical problem. it's not a problem that a policymaker or a professional can really fix. It's not something that can be fixed from top down. It's not a technical problem with an answer for how you do it. It's a political problem. It involves, and not political in terms of political parties or anything like that, but small p politics. Just, it requires people coming together and making a decision together about what needs to be done and then working together to be able to implement that. That's what actually is required for education to get better and for the achievement gap to be closed. While certainly there are many things that, from a top-down solution that could help, a national policy on education, universal national standards, maybe a different funding model, whatever people want to do, those top-down solutions could probably help, but they wouldn't be able to solve the problem on their own because it's not a technical problem with a specific best practice that can just eliminate it. It has to be solved by communities. So how Kettering found out about this was that in 2007, people held forums around the country, and we actually decided to go back and visit seven of these places and talk to them about the experience that they'd had in the forums. And what they talked about was that, as I said, when they were discussing the achievement gap, they saw many gaps. They saw in various places poverty, uninvolved parents, or parents who had maybe not had the best experience with school themselves, so they had a difficult time navigating it with their children again. White flight, lack of role models in communities, English language learners, a high percentage of those that can make it more difficult for a school to make the adequate yearly progress that people want for them. Low expectations by students themselves, by parents, by teachers, by the community at large. And the thing that was interesting, though, was that a lot of times when you hear this problem, the achievement gap talked about, people talk about it like it's this national blight. It's this national problem, and it's kind of pretty much the same everywhere. But when people talked about it, they saw it as having usually specifically local causes. Some of the problems showed up in various locations. For instance, we went to Helena, Arkansas, Mobile, Alabama, Panama City, Florida, Bridgeport, Connecticut, Cincinnati, Ohio, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and a number of other places. And we saw that a lot of people said similar things, that it was poverty was a problem because there was not much of an economy for kids to be motivated to join into when they got done with school, because the economy in their town wasn't thriving. There wasn't any money for parents to provide extra funding for the schools or more educational opportunities outside of schools. Poverty came up in a lot of places. So did low expectations. But people did not necessarily see these as, again, being a national thing. They thought that the poverty in their community or the low expectations in their community were also caused by something that was local, and that necessarily only they locally could use the resources they had to combat those problems. And sometimes some of the problem was that the schools were trying to cope with everything, when in fact there are certain gaps that only parents, individuals, citizens working together, or communities as a whole can fill. So when they decided to talk about these problems this way, they talked about what they saw as being the gaps and what they saw as being possible solutions that they could put into practice on their own without waiting for federal grant money or, you know, some big educational organization to come to town and tell them kind of what to do. And depending on what different communities saw as being their problems, they took action based on the conversations that they had in these forums. And what the documentary was about was going to these different places and seeing what occurred from that. And basically, I would say that three themes really came out from all the communities. One was that more money alone wouldn't solve the problem. While most people said that more money for certain things would help, maybe some more money for schools, maybe some more money for, you know, outside of school programs, more money alone wouldn't solve the problem, because this isn't a problem that money can solve. And this is an argument that makes a lot of sense to people this is something that people can get caught on when they talk about, you know, not wanting to reward failing schools. The money can really complicate the issue, and people will point to the fact that it's even mentioned in the documentary. You know, there are lots of failing schools that are in brand new buildings, and there are all kinds of money and expertise being thrown at it, you know. But the problem is not necessarily right in the schools. A lot of times the problems can be in the community or in the home, and there's nothing really the school can do about those problems. The community has to see and be engaged and decide that they're going to do something about the problems that they themselves have identified. That's actually pretty much the second finding, which was, and we just heard this everywhere we went, it takes a village. But it takes a working village. It takes a village where people can actually talk together about these problems in a productive way, you know, not get caught up in polarization and name-calling and blaming, and then decide to take action together in a productive way. people have used the documentary to start conversations, just like the ones that you can see in the film, in Maryland, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, not to mention all the places that held the original forums. We've been thinking that with there's so much concern in Dayton over the state of public education, maybe Dayton could be next.
Amy Lee with the Kettering Foundation on Communities Confronting the Achievement Gap. The full interview can be found at SOCHE.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Lots of attention is being paid to the presidential race here in Ohio, but in this state, we also have one of the most contentious Senate races as well. Here to talk to me about the race between Democrat Sherrod Brown and Republican challenger Josh Mandel is Karen Kassler with our Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
Let's step back for a moment and look at the big picture. Right now, how does this Senate race play into this idea as one of the races to watch?
Well, I think what's happened here is that you had Republican interest in this seat all along. Republicans had thought that Sherrod Brown was vulnerable this time around, and Josh Mandel was the top vote getter in 2010 in Ohio, right behind Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor of the Ohio Supreme Court. And he's a prolific fundraiser. So I think the Republican Party looked at this race as one that they could win and potentially gain control of the U.S. Senate. That's not working out right now, at least when you look at the polls. The polls are showing that this race is not only neck and neck, which it was for a while, it's actually now the Quinnipiac CBS News New York Times poll this week showed that Sherrod Brown is leading by 10 points over Josh Mandel. So there's been a lot of interest in this race all along, and of course the outside groups. The outside spending in this race is $19.5 million against Sherrod Brown and about $7 million against Josh Mandel. So there's a lot of interest in this race nationally as well as here in the state.
You mentioned the polling numbers. I mean, it looked like that latest poll shows a double-digit lead between the two. And I'm wondering, what does the Mandel campaign have to do to close that gap?
Well, first of all, a lot of Republicans are saying that poll is wrong, that poll overestimates Democratic turnout, that Democratic turnout would be bigger than it was in 2008. And they say that poll is wrong. They're not disputing that they might indeed be behind, but they say that this 10-point gap, and in other states, the gap in the presidential race is much bigger than that. They say that that's just not the case. Josh Mandel is saying his own internal polling is showing that he is actually leading Sherrod Brown. So I think, you know, you have a debate over whether the polls are right or wrong, but certainly Mandel does have an issue. If Obama's leading in Ohio, there's a potential that Sherrod Brown could win on that coattails. And so Mandel has to, at this point, decide whether he wants to continue with the campaign that he's running or change the direction. At least that's what I get. I talked to two messaging strategists over the weekend for our TV show, and they were saying that it looks like Josh Mandel is at a turning point here, and which way does he want to go in his campaign?
You reported this week that this race is also getting increasingly nasty, and the attack ads from both sides are showing no signs of slowing.
We need a senator who shows up to work. Sherrod Brown missed over 350 official votes. When he finally showed up, voted to raise his own pay 6 times.
Josh Mandel, he's become the candidate of the big lie. Fact-checkers call his attacks pants on fire. He may be the most dishonest candidate in the country.
Some really harsh words there from Senator Brown. What's he talking about here?
Well, this pants on fire rating is the worst rating that the fact-checking organization PolitiFact, which works out of the Plain Dealer and other newspapers, that's the worst rating that they hand out. They've handed it to Josh Mandel 6 times in this campaign, and it means that not only is the statement false, but it's so false that it's almost off the charts false. Now, Sherrod Brown has gotten a false statement as well, and he's even gotten a pants on fire, but it's been nowhere near what Josh Mandel has added up to. And, you know, Mandel says he stands by the rulings that have gotten him the pants on fire, the statements that have gotten him the pants on fire. He says he stands by those statements, that he has facts that prove this. He has no idea why PolitiFact would rule against him. And he actually cites PolitiFact in rulings that they've made against Sherrod Brown. But then Mandel says that PolitiFact is wrong on rulings they made against him. The whole idea here, though, is that this is a very, very nasty campaign. These are two combatants who may or may not have expected to be going at each other quite as much as they are. And it's gotten nasty not only with the outside spending against the candidates, but then with the candidates going up against each other.
The debates are coming up. And what do you think that we're going to expect to see from both of those from both Senator Brown and Josh Mandel?
Well, I get the pleasure of being the moderator for the first debate, which is October 15th before the City Club of Cleveland. They're both from the Cleveland area. So this should be very interesting to see them on their home turf, so to speak. And this is going to be a battle between two very, very different candidates. Sherrod Brown is a seasoned veteran. He's been doing this for 38 years. Josh Mandel is considered a rising star in the Republican Party. He has a lot of supporters of his own. And so it's going to be very interesting to watch these two candidates play off each other for the first time, being in the same room in front of an audience. They've been in the same room in front of editorial boards, and it's gotten fiery. I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens when you put these two gentlemen in front of a live audience and they have to take questions.
You can see a full interview with Karen Kassler and Sherrod Brown and Josh Mandel on the State of Ohio, carried on PBS stations this weekend. Karen Kassler with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be with you.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.